Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today, we have a very, very special episode for you. We are continuing with our mythology series with the fan-critic-alike favorite episode, Memento Mori, but with a little bit of a special addition, we have Frank Spotnitz, the Frank Spotnitz, on the pod to chat specifically about Memento Mori.
Yes.
We went into a deep dive with Frank on this episode, which, let me tell you, was so much fun. We were so glad to have him back. And if you haven't already heard our interview with Frank, you need to go back and listen to it. It was released last year, I believe. God, time is sure flying, Jen.
Yeah, it sure is.
We recorded this quite a while ago, so we have been sitting on it for a very long time. We are very excited to share it with you. But before we get to the interview, let's read some tweets of the week.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, tweets of the week. These are in response to our last mythology episode, our most recent episode, which was the X-Files episode, Terma, second of the two-part Tunguska Terma. And some wonderful insights, as usual, from our awesome listeners. Scully's Cardigan said, thank you for the Galileo info. And this is in reference to the tagline at the beginning, E pur si muove, pardon my terrible Latin, Italian, whatever that is. So Scully's Cardigan says, I feel like that touches everything in the episode. And we get a great list here. Mulder keeps on his quest. I should actually remind everyone as well before I read this that and yet it moves is the translation for that.
Right.
And Scully's Cardigan says, Mulder keeps on his quest despite Scully being tied up at trial. The old woman plans to die and yet is infected with the sentient black oil instead. Peskov's retired, but this endless plot sweeps him back up. The trial persists, even though well-manicured man and CSM wish it to stop. And corruption makes Scully's job impossible, and the hearing is a wash, but she never stops pursuing the truth, nor presenting her real concerns to the court. Really, really awesome.
Yeah. Nice breakdown.
Observations from Scully's Cardigan there. I like that a lot. That's a terrific analysis of the many different ways that tagline applies to these episodes or to that episode in particular.
Yeah, you know, her list made me think of what we were talking about when we were talking about the episode when the prisoner was talking about the persistence of life, which is another kind of example of, and yet it moves. It just continues on. Mm-hmm. It continues and goes and goes and goes. You know, like Mulder. And that's another, I think, nice connection that I just thought of. But
I think it's great. Yeah, that applies in way more ways than I had ever thought. So I really appreciate those insights.
Yeah.
Recently Spooked says, I love this. I love Scully's power stride through the gate as she's held in contempt. She's storming ahead of her guard. How does she know which cell she's heading to? What if she strides past it? She'd have to double back. The confidence, right? Recently Spooked, that is so, that's such a great scene, and that's a great way of describing it.
Yeah, I never ever thought of that before, but when that was pointed out, I'm like, you're right. But I'm, now that I think about it, was there somebody at the door waiting? Was there somebody holding the door open?
Because I don't know, but I love that idea though.
It is, I do love the idea that, like, she's going into this cell, nobody is holding her, no one's got her.
Yeah.
I mean, in this sort of situation, I don't think that it calls for handcuffs or anything like that. So you just get walked down the hallway like you're being sent to the principal's office, essentially.
Yeah.
But you're right. Like, she's like several strides in front of everyone else. And what if she just walks right past where they're going? I'm trying to remember if there's somebody standing there. Maybe there was, and I'm just blanking, but
I do really like the way Scully's just, it is a great sort of edit, a cut right to that as soon as they ask the question that we know is going to hold her in contempt.
It's one of the best smash cuts of the series. Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
So good. Mm-hmm. And she's just like owning it. Mm-hmm. She's not like, oh, woe be gone, poor me. She's like, fine, fuck you. Hold me in contempt. Go for it. I shall enter into it willingly.
See how little I care. Yeah.
See how little I care. I love it. I love that observation from Recently Spooked.
Yep.
Rachel is blue, really bringing some great observation as well. Rachel says, love your coverage of the mythology. Regarding well-manicured man saying, they are all honorable, these honorable men. He's quoting Mark Antony's Friends, Romans, Countrymen speech at Caesar's burial. Of course, well-manicured man is well-versed in ancient power dynamics. Thank you, Rachel. I did not know that. I feel as though, I mean...
I didn't either.
From, of course, that's Shakespeare's play, Julius Caesar. And I feel like maybe I should have my English degree withdrawn because I didn't recognize that at all. But in my defense, it's been a long time since I've read Julius Caesar. But thank you, Rachel, very much for pointing that out. I kind of went back and read that whole speech from Mark Antony in Julius Caesar. It's a great speech.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot there about power dynamics, and it is used in the same way that well-manicured man uses it, in the sense it's like sarcastic, essentially.
Right.
It's like, oh, these are all honorable, these honorable men. So it's like, a really interesting parallel.
Literally everything comes from Shakespeare.
Right.
Everything is derivative of Shakespeare, I've come to realize, like everything. Yeah. But like,
yeah,
I actually did not remember that either. Thank you. Who pointed that out? Rachel?
That's Rachel. Rachel is blue.
I didn't know that either, even though I took a Shakespeare course in college as well. Only one for fun, because I'm a psycho person. But
that is a bit psycho.
It was a really good class, but I don't remember if we covered Julius Caesar, actually, now that I think about it. So I can feel like I can let myself off the hook.
You, however, totally can have
a degree,
I'm definitely on the bit
of a harder time.
And I actually work in an English department now. I mean, I'm an admin assistant. I'm not teaching class, but still, I'm surrounded by Shakespeare at all times.
We can't know them all, Jen. It's all right.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's why we have awesome listeners like Rachel to fill in the blanks. Thank you, Rachel. Isadub says, as for Terma, it's a messy episode concerning the action scenes and the plot line. Lower average ep for me. I guess Canada was needed because nobody bothers there when oil pipes are blowing up, or maybe because you can find abandoned refineries. Maybe Jen could shine a light on it. I'd like to be able to, as a dub. I mean, my first reaction is to say, yes, of course we notice when oil pipes are blowing up here in Alberta, where I live. But I had to think about it a bit, and I'm like, well, I mean, like, there's a lot of problems with oil lines and oil refineries and oil wells here in Alberta. And honestly, it doesn't always get the attention it should, because oil and gas runs the province of Alberta, for those that may not know this. And just me talking about this subject, I feel like someone is going to get me into huge trouble in Alberta, because as soon as you start talking about oil, you're on tricky ground.
Uh-oh.
But there's tends to be a downplaying of anything negative to do with oil and gas. I mean, there was a fire at a refinery outside of Edmonton a couple of weeks ago, and it went on for days, and it really didn't get very much coverage in the news. It was just like, oh yeah, there's that fire still burning at that refinery, but let's move on to other news.
And
Maybe in Alberta, we're just kind of like, wells blow up and everyone just kind of says, no, let's not discuss that. Let's move on.
I think you might be onto something, actually.
I think she has really kind of brought up the point that, yeah, if you want to get away with anything oil related, Alberta's probably the place to do it, because no one dare even speak against the oil industry here. So I, on the other hand, am not like super pro oil and gas, but I've said too much already. So thank you, Isadub, for bringing that up. And from Tanya Patino, I think. Hi, Tanya. Tanya says, this episode made me want to rewatch Tunguska Terma all over again. Such fond memories back in 97 when I watched. Yeah. I stayed till the end to listen to the announcement. Great guest for the upcoming week. Looking forward to listening to it as always. So are we, Tanya. Thank you very much. It's very exciting. Thanks everyone for all of your observations and questions and thoughts. We love to hear from you guys. You always have interesting perspectives that we enjoy. So find us on Twitter and join in on the conversation anytime at XFD Podcast, and we look forward to seeing you there.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
We're so happy that you came back to be on the show again. We're very excited. So Memento Mori, Obviously, this is one of your favorite episodes. This is what you told us last time we chatted. So you must have a really strong personal connection to it. Can you tell us a little bit about your conceptualization for it? And, you know, you talked to us a little bit about Scully's cancer arc and how it was sort of your idea. We'd like to hear some more about that.
Well, looking back on it, I was always excited for opportunities to have character through lines for Mulder and Scully, because most of the episodes, by definition, were plot driven, right? All the standalone Monster of the Week type episodes were plot driven, and there was very little character change or growth or development, because those episodes, by and large, could be shown in any order. And it was really the mythology episodes where you had a chance to sort of have them change and grow, and they have a memory of things that had happened to them in their personal lives in those stories. Mm-hmm. And after Nisi in 731, when Scully discovered all these other women who had been abducted and who had cancer, I felt like beginning the new season, season four, we had to pick up on that. We had not picked up on it. We had to. And generally, each season, we would have a sort of brief discussion with all the writers about where the season was going. And then, honestly, it was really Chris and me who did the mythology stories. And then I would sometimes bring in other people to pitch them to or discuss the ideas, you know, like John Scheiben with. But it wasn't generally a group thing, the mythology episodes. But at a meeting at the beginning of the fourth season, I had suggested that we should pick up on Scully's cancer. And there was one executive there, a guy from the studio, who really shot it down and said, you know, that's just not this show. That's very soapy. And, you know, that's not what the fans expect. And I said, gosh, it just seems to me like it creates a real continuity problem for the narrative. Why doesn't Scully get this? But I kind of lost the argument at that point. And but I wasn't going to give up. I was going to look for my moment. So then I tell you guys the Darren Morgan story last time? Did we talk about that?
Something about him writing an episode and it was the order was swapped or something, I think.
Also, you know, Darren had left the show after the third season.
Right.
And he said, but I will write an episode in the fourth season. Even though I won't be on staff, I will deliver a script for another episode. We're like, fantastic. That'll be great. And he was due to deliver that episode right before Christmas. And, you know, we would always start writing in June. And by Christmas, we were always exhausted, running on fumes, and couldn't wait for those 2 weeks off. And Darren's episode was supposed to come in just to prep 3 days before the Christmas break. And Darren called and said, I don't have a script. And we didn't know that. We were really counting on him delivering a script.
Oops.
Ooh.
Yeah. And it was a real crisis. And we had nothing. We had no ideas on the shelf, nothing. And so that's when I said, okay, that's it. Scully's getting cancer.
So it's Darren's fault that Scully got cancer.
It's Darren's fault. Thanks to Darren. Because it was like we had to come up with something, and I had this idea already in my head that she had cancer, and it was coincidence that we'd already written Leonard Betts and that Leonard Betts preyed on people who had cancer. That was just happenstance.
Right.
But we saw immediately that how, you know, you could have Leonard Betts lead to the Scully cancer diagnosis that begins with Memento Mori. But it was only 3 days before the Christmas break. So the reason that episode is written by John, Vince, Chris, and me is because we were in such a crisis.
You guys were scrambling.
We scrambled. So in one day, John, Vince, and I broke the story that became Memento Mori in one day.
Wow.
And then the next day, we split the script into thirds, and each of us wrote a third of the script. We each wrote like 17 pages. And then we literally stitched it together on the third day and handed it to production to prep.
Which third did you write? I'm curious.
I think I wrote either the first or the second. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And we did it. And we're like, phew, we did it. And then Chris took that over the Christmas holiday and he rewrote it. And that's why that episode has four names on it. The only one in the entire run of the series that has four names on it.
I was going to ask about that because it is typical that it's just you and Chris doing the mythology. And it was interesting to see Vince and John's name on there. What were you going to say, Jen?
I was just going to jump in and just ask about there were these concerns about the cancer arc at the beginning of the season from the powers that be. Did you just, guys, when it became like an urgent situation, did you just decide we just won't tell them? Or yeah, the network was like, do whatever you got to do at this point?
Yeah, I just thought I'm not even going to ask.
It was a better to beg forgiveness than ask permission situation.
Yeah, exactly. And what are they going to do? I mean, it's like they know the script. So, and I never did hear from that guy again. It was never, it never came up again as a complaint.
But, well, it ended up being one of the best arcs of the series. So I guess they can't really complain. So
it did. And you know, I felt the reason I love that episode is because it is so simple. It's the only standalone mythology episode of the series.
Yeah.
And it is so emotional. It is such a love story from the very first scene. And I remember watching the dailies, and in my memory, that first scene was the first thing I saw in dailies. And I knew it was going to be a great episode for Jillian. Or of course, it's going to be a great episode for Jillian. But what I didn't realize is what a great episode was going to be for David.
Yeah.
And I found his reaction to her diagnosis. I hadn't appreciated how moving his inability to accept her diagnosis was going to be. Mm. Like, refusing to accept it, insistent that there must be a way around this.
Yeah.
It just was so, you know, touching. And it told you how much these two people loved each other without them having to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, she was moving too because she's so brave and, you know, unself-pitying. But, you know, that gets back to why I was so eager to do this in the first place, is because it was characterful. And you often didn't get the chance to do characterful stuff from Mulder and Scully.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good point you bring up about sort of, I mean, I think David often, his acting slightly gets overlooked because of the subtle nature of it. And it is some really good work he's doing in those scenes where he's sort of trying to control his emotion, but he's trying to be rational for her sake, speak her language. But that's a really good point that you bring that up. I think those scenes with the two of them are so good. And in general, I feel like Mulder is very... he's a lot more he defers a lot more to her in this episode. Like, there's one of my favorite lines, and I know, Jen, this is one of your favorite lines in the episode of all time, is when he's trying to relay all this information to her over the phone. We're kind of jumping into the middle of the episode, and she's like, no, Mulder, I need you to bring my stuff to the hospital. And he just stops and he just says, I will be right there. And it's just such a nice character moment for him because we don't see that Mulder very often. It's usually go, go, go. Find the solution, fix the problem. But he is just there for her. And it's very, it's very sweet. Yeah. Nice to see.
And it's such a simple line, but delivered so well by David. It just makes it heartbreaking.
Yes. Yeah. And also, I think you're absolutely right. And I remember that really vividly too, that scene. When you think about the arc of their relationship over the course of the show, you know, in the beginning, she's kind of like the student or the disciple. Like, she's coming in and this guy's this brilliant profiler with this reputation. And yes, she sent a spy on him, but she's younger and less experienced. And there is this sort of, you know, unequal power dynamic in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But by season four, that's gone.
Yeah.
You know, by season four, Scully is testifying before Congress.
Yeah.
Season four, Scully has come into her own, and you see how much Mulder needs her, you know, which is it's in the movie explicitly. Mm-hmm. And it's not a coincidence that, you know, we're writing the movie around the same time.
Right. Going back quick, just real quick to your, just the conceptualization of it. I can't say that word for some reason today. There's a clear arc, I feel like, and you brought it up, from Nisei all the way up through Memento Mori, with indications that Scully is sort of on some level aware that she might be dying. It's like almost like she's subconsciously repressing it. And I know you've said that, like, you know, everybody's been resistant to it, but were those moments built into the episodes intentionally in case you guys decided to pick up that thread? Some examples that that come to my mind are, in Quagmire, her statement that Mulder's obsession will leave him dead along with everyone else he brings with him, or her fear about the implant in Wet-Wired. And also something that some fans have brought to our attention is the location of the howlers in Unruhe is like right in the head, and he points at her head. It feels like these are all so purposeful, and yet they could be completely coincidental. Do you have any recollection of those?
Well, the Wet-Wired one is probably not coincidental, because that's a John Gilnitz episode. That was one where John, Vince, and I, you know, worked on that. And so it was certainly in my mind. And then with the Unruh, that was a Vince episode, and he certainly would have been present for that conversation about the idea of Scully getting cancer. I don't know whether that was deliberate. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling with what was the first one you mentioned? The
Quagmire bit.
Quagmire episode. I have a feeling that was more just being funny. But
Yeah. It's not like that could specifically allude to this. Just I think Scully was in general probably feeling that at the time. But yeah. It has an extra layer when you sort of look at it as, I don't know, the idea that she is aware that this happened to her. She's aware that all of these women pulled the implants out, and she's aware that they're all dying. Yes. And so on some level, you think, like you said, it was like, if we didn't pick up this plot point, people would be like, well, what was so special about Scully? What happened to Scully? Like, why didn't she die? So it just seems like it makes complete sense for it to go this direction. And it's a good thing that you guys picked it up. So
I think the other thing I'll say, just in defense of the studio network guy, is that, you know, remembering like the whole idea of a quote unquote mythology and the serialized element of the X-Files, that was still... we were kind of making it up as we go along, right? So it was like, yes, you could say there were mythology episodes in season one, but it really was Jillian's pregnancy in season two that really caused, in my mind, and I wasn't there when those episodes were written, but I was there immediately afterwards. And I feel right. like they kind of stumbled into this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I was acutely aware, because somehow I became one of the guys that was supposed to continue these episodes. I was acutely aware of the need to continue and to have continuity for the continuing storyline. But I think a lot of people in Network and Studio weren't really quite aware the show had become that still at the beginning of the season. So.
And there's also the element of that, like, people who are watching the show now have the luxury of sort of skipping through and watching what they want when they want it. And at the time, you know, we couldn't do that. You had to constantly be like, okay, well, what are people going to actually remember? We want to treat the audience like they're smart, but we also don't want to make sure they don't miss things. So, I mean, I can imagine it was probably much different trying to pick up and drop these threads at the time than it would be making a show today.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely right. And the other thing that's interesting, thinking back on it, is that, you know, many shows would keep a Bible that they would write down everything that had happened in the show. And if a writer joined the staff, you could have that Bible. And Chris refused to do that with the X-Files. Mm-hmm. He thought that it would become a crutch for writers. And they, instead of watching the episodes, they would just turn to this, like, Cliff's notes. So it was a lot for us to keep in our heads, like, what has happened? What haven't we returned to, especially as the show went on, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. I was amazed, because I would go on the internet and follow fan reactions, and people remembered. They really, even if they hadn't seen, you know, like you said, there were no, you know, there were very few VHS episodes available at that point.
Yeah.
You couldn't, repeats weren't easy to come by, but people would remember episodes they'd seen 9 months, a year and a half earlier. They'd remember whether we picked up on something or and gotten it right.
People were creating their own show Bibles, probably.
Yeah. And we all had our own homemade collection of VHS tapes as well that we would refer to frequently.
Yeah. That's true. The hardcore fans definitely had access to all of those shows when they could, I think. But it's funny that you bring up the show Bible, because I feel like that's something that constantly gets lampooned by people, like, oh, I can't believe they didn't have a show Bible because these little things were not consistent or whatever, whatever. But like, I don't know, part of me, and Jen and I were having this conversation because we were recently discussing Apocrypha and the Piper Maru arc. And we were talking about how if you can accept the fact that like life doesn't always have everything sort of wrapped up into a pretty bow, and you're not going to necessarily get an answer to every single thing, some things just kind of are, they just kind of are. And that's kind of how I like look at the X-Files as different to other shows, because you guys, you did that purposefully. There were a lot of things that you just didn't follow up on because that's life. That's the X-Files. That's the X. That's, we don't know, and we're not supposed to know.
Yep. And I think there's a mistake in chasing facts or continuity. And I think what people really want is sort of the emotional truth of the show, and yeah, and you, that you honor that. And I mean, I do think, like, looking back on the season finale of season 9, the series finale of season 9, that was our attempt to try and pick up as many breadcrumbs as we possibly could before mm-hmm. the show. And looking back on it, I think it was a mistake, because I don't think that's what people care about. You know, they much more they care about the emotional lives of the characters and the journey that the characters have been on. And right. I think when we followed that instinct, we were at our best.
Going back to what you said about the Jillian's pregnancy sort of kind of angling the arc of the mythology, and the idea of her fertility being a continuing plot point throughout the series, that is actually very big in Memento Mori as well. Were the seeds being planted for that intentionally? Like, were you always sort of planting or planning on going that route with Scully's character?
Well, as I said, I wasn't there when Jillian was pregnant and they wrote those episodes in one breath. But I know that Chris said, well, since she's pregnant, let's get these shots of her in the alien abduction thing and with the mm-hmm. thing going into her stomach. And so I knew that was a piece we had. It was a visual we had. It was a part of her abduction storyline we had. So, and this often happened with the mythology episodes, we think, what are the pieces we have? And what have we done with them? What haven't we done? And so it just felt organic to use this fertility question and to pull it forward into Memento Mori, which we did. And then, of course, much later in the series, you know, to have her give birth to William just felt like it was coming full circle. You know, it was Gillian Anderson's real life pregnancy that kind of gave birth to the mythology.
Yeah.
Now there's Scully giving birth to a child. Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually wanted to ask you, we're going to jump back to that because since you brought it up, Frank, in Permanum, which is season 8, obviously, that's probably the biggest episode that has to deal with her fertility, because that's talking about her doing the IVF and all of those things. There's a scene in that episode where Mulder actually tells her that he kept her ova way back from Memento Mori. And I'm going to ask you a little bit more about that. But my question is, when in your mind, because Permanum was one of your episodes, was that scene meant to have taken place? Like, or is this just sort of very nebulous? Like, when does Mulder actually tell her that he has the ova?
This is so embarrassing, because since I Want to Believe, people have been asking me this question. Mm-hmm. And I've been promising that I'm going to go back and watch Permanum again, and I'm going to answer this question. And it's been 12 years and I still haven't done it.
So, fair enough.
Worst procrastinator in the world. I need to go back and watch Permanum and then I'll give you an answer. But I literally haven't watched the episode since it was broadcast.
Wow. Okay. Well, we're going to have to come back
discuss that another day.
We will have to do that, because that, I mean, and now a lot of people wonder, just because it's just an interesting development that Mulder would have this information that's very, very important, or would be very, very important to Scully, and he withholds it for so long. And I mean, I know that this is not one of Mulder's best moments. I think a lot of people might agree with that. Although at the same time, I can understand why he's doing it. Like, I can understand why he would want to keep that from her, because I think Mulder does that. I think he does keep things from Scully.
I think that we as writers thought he's doing it to protect her. Or, and we would have all these reasons why it was, in his mind, justified. But I also think, you know, looking back on it now, and I don't think I was conscious of this at the time, but I do think it's true now. It's part of the tension in their relationship is that Mulder is a withholding person who doesn't share or, you know, trust no one. He doesn't trust even Scully. He keeps a lot from her. And that is probably, you know, another element of the DNA of their relationship that makes it so intriguing, you know, because it's not, they're two people who are brought together by the work and separated by their work. And, and that's another element of the sexual, you know, it's not just sexual tension between them. There's a romantic, you know, and character tension between them. And I, that's another element of it is his, you know, he's hard to pin down. He's always up to something. He's always got that smile. He's always, you know, got his own agenda.
Yeah.
And Scully is much more straightforward and rational and fair, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, she tells him in this episode, in their first scene, that you're the only one I've called, which is a huge deal. I mean, and you can tell, and I want to talk about this scene next, that her mother is not very thrilled about this. Because, I mean, and I mean, she doesn't even end up telling her mom. I mean, Mulder is the one who allegedly tells her mother that her daughter has cancer. I mean, I would have loved to have seen that scene, personally. But is that, was that your intention, that like Scully is just not wanting to communicate to her mother, or she's just downplaying this? Because I feel like her mom always sees right through her. And I love that scene between Jillian and Sheila. It's just, it's so great and emotional.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something about Scully and her mother. There's like an independence and a desire to do it herself. And, you know, I guess I always thought Scully was tried to be like her father in a way, And I think her mother was always trying to reach Scully, but Scully, just like Mulder is sometimes evasive with Scully, Scully is sometimes evasive with her mother, I think.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I speaking of the Scully family, I know, Jen, though, did you have any questions about that, Mama Scully, I just call her Mama Scully, scene with Maggie and Scully? I know you were really a fan of that scene.
I'm a fan of any time that Margaret Scully shows up. She's, I love her. I love Sheila Larkin. And yeah, I think it's a, I think they have such a interesting dynamic. It's not, I think you've explained it really well, Frank, that it's not just a simple mother-daughter we love each other kind of relationship. It's like any real mother-daughter relationship. There's certain tensions there and layers. And I've always liked that. And I think that that's, we see that in this episode. It's one of the things I love about Memento Mori is how many characters you manage to fit in to this episode, how many continuing characters. Yes. You know, we got Margaret Scully, we've got Skinner, CSM, the Lone Gunman, and the fact that they all seem to belong there and that they all contribute to the story. And I like the way you did that with Margaret Scully as well.
Yeah. And also, I think it's an interesting arc with her all the way through to Redux, when there's a point where Scully actually does sort of break down and give in to her mom and relay her fears. And that's a nice little kind of cap to this scene. Because yes. I feel for her, like as a mom, I feel for her just kind of being kept on the inside or kept on the outside when so many horrible things have already happened.
Yes.
And just that fear that something is going to happen and she's powerless to stop it. It's just, it's a really good scene.
Yeah. And just that very brief allusion, you are my only daughter now. Just a little hint referring back to Melissa. It's just, love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I love that too. And I love the Redux episodes too.
Redux. Oh. That's intense. I want to talk about this deleted scene that was in this episode. We both had access to the script and we were able to read it. And the scene with Bill that was taken out, and it's on YouTube. It's like available to see. So we've seen it too. And we actually had Pat Skipper on the podcast a while back and he was chatting about that scene too. I'm curious if there is I mean, was it just a timing issue? Or, I mean, because I kind of like the way that you guys ended up introducing Bill later in Gethsemane. I think that the way he's introduced is better than it would be in this scene, because he is harsh, like extremely harsh with Scully in this scene. So my question would be, was there a reason that you guys deleted it?
It was a time issue. In fact, the Sheila Jillian scene, it was cut. If you look at the script, that we had to shorten that scene. We were looking for time to get to the running time, because back in those days you had to hit the running time. Mm. But yes, looking at the scene when it was performed, we felt like Bill, who we didn't even know, came in and was just so unsympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And hard, and we just thought, and it's not Pat's fault, this was us as writers, we just felt like there's a better way to introduce this character than this, and so we needed to find the time, and we thought we'll pull this out and we'll find a better way to introduce him. And I have to say, I think there was at one point there was yet another Scully sibling.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you about that. Charles. he brings him up in the script. Yeah. What are your thoughts on Charles?
We meant to introduce Charles. Well, we had a whole thing about Charles, which I've forgotten now, of course. But we just never could find the screen time to introduce Charles as well. But we certainly, like in season five, I'm sure there were drafts of treatments anyway where Charles existed, but he never quite made it to screen.
There's lots of speculation in the fandom about what his backstory is. Everyone's just made up their own story about where he is and what he's doing.
We may have documents somewhere that show what we thought Charles was going to be, but I can't remember.
Frank, can I just ask quickly? There was obviously some cuts for time, and I'm guessing that's a pretty common thing. But I'm wondering if there was more than there normally would be for an episode because of the fact that you had to kind of rush this into production and maybe didn't have the timing quite as fine as you normally would.
No, I think it was. It wasn't uncommon that we had to cut scenes or shorten things and tighten things up to hit the running time. And this one, I think the only thing that was unpredictable was how long all those voiceovers were going to take. You know, right. The montages of Scully going through the chemotherapy and those voiceovers. But otherwise, I think it was not unusual.
Mm. The final product is very similar to the script, which isn't always the case. So it seems like it came out pretty close to what you at least had anticipated in your original draft or your original vision of it.
Well, as was so often the case when Rob Bowman was directing, the dailies would come in and you'd go, this is not only as good as I hoped it would be, it's better than I hoped it would be. You know, many, many times when you're doing television and directors come in and out, they're like, you know, guest directors. It's never really made sense to me as a way of doing television, is that you go through all this effort and then the director comes in, you don't even know this person. And they're actually the ones making the show. Mm. And very, very often you're watching dailies going, oh gosh, how are we going to fix this? How are we going to, in editorial, how are we going to make this work? Because it's not what we intended in the script. But when Rob or Kim would direct, it was like it was usually better than what you imagined.
You never had, that was never a concern, obviously. So that's a nice thing to not have to worry about.
Yeah.
You brought up those montages, or not montages, sorry, those monologues, like the letters that Scully is writing to Mulder. In your mind, is this just something that came about of this episode? Like she's starting to see her mortality and she is writing these things to Mulder, or is this something that Scully just kind of does sometimes? She write things to Mulder and then not send them?
My memory is that that didn't exist in the draft that John Vince and I wrote. And that was something that Chris came up with. I think Chris was really moved by and taken with the cancer storyline. And I think he was excited by the chance to talk about something that wasn't supernatural, that people actually go through, that we knew millions of our viewers in real life would go through. And so I think that's why, you know, I think the she talks about this being science's demon possession. It's like, this is a real life X-File, you know, unfortunately. And I think, and I never asked him about this, but I think he was he was relishing the opportunity to write this to the audience and to write this to people out there who really have battled cancer. So I think that's why that Scully letter exists in the episode.
In a way, though, that it really does feel like this sort of unexplainable malevolent force, which at the end of the day, I'm sorry, my cat is just really loud.
She's in another.
She wants to be on the podcast every time. Which is an X-File in and of itself. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be paranormal to be mysterious. So that's a really good thing. And that doesn't surprise me that Chris, because Chris does enjoy those monologues, those kind of long, I don't know, the kind of like, you know, in The Blessing Way and even later in Redux, there's a lot of that going on, kind of giving us a window into their minds. And for two characters that we don't really get a lot of that from, it's nice to see. And the letters are also very, very romantic, I think, personally. Yes.
Absolutely.
I mean, she's still like, she's dying. And you see this again in Redux. Her only concern is that Mulder's going to be left alone to do this without her. And I find that just so compelling. It's just really, really great.
Well, yeah, we were aware, like, these are truly heroic characters. These are romantic with a small R characters. Mm-hmm. They are really good people, you know, and really brave and heroic people. And I think you see that reflected in the storyline. And it's, you know, Mulder had lost his sister to alien abduction, and Scully had lost her sister to, you know, assassination. And here we are threatening one of them, you know, their own lives. It's a way to sort of escalate the stakes, if you will. And they just face it with such bravery. It is very touching.
Yeah. And I mean, too, she's also probably thinking of his reaction to Samantha, like, constantly, like, she would just become another Samantha for him, and she doesn't want that for him. I just find that really, really compelling and selfless of her. It's just really, really nice. I want to talk again about the connection between the fertility and the cancer, because this Dr. Scanlon character who we meet in this episode, you know, and I love the way you guys introduce him. It, like, she wakes up and it's like this white light, almost like she thinks she's back in the bad place, right? Mm-hmm. And it's this doctor who's presumably coming to help save her life, but then really we find out that no, this is just another evil doctor that is tampering with her. I think that's so interesting, and I love the idea that, like, Scully, she has to go through her life, like, she just has to live her life and do everything she has to do and not worry that every single doctor she comes into contact with is like an evil, in evil cahoots with all the other doctors. But that's exactly what happens to poor Scully. Like, she goes to the IVF. I'm like, I'm thinking again of season 8 when, like, obviously this is all interconnected, but we are just seeing little bits and pieces of it. But I just feel so bad for Scully, because it's like, it comes across like she is being irresponsible, but what are her choices? Like, what is she supposed to do? Like, how is she supposed to know that not every doctor is completely evil? I don't have a question. I'm just pointing that out. I feel so bad for her.
I think that just speaks to our paranoia, that we're paranoid of everyone, you know, and a doctor is such an intimate relationship that is so dependent on trust. So to have somebody that you cannot trust playing that role is such a violation, mm-hmm. that I think it appeals to that part of us as storytellers. But it's about our general paranoia rather than her judgment, I think.
Yeah, it's not, and I'm not necessarily saying it's about her judgment. You see her inner turmoil and conflict, especially throughout season 8, this is just one episode. I mean, in season 8, it's the entire season, and you see her going like, no, it's fine, everything's fine, everything's fine, and we're like, no, this is the X-Files, everything is not fine. And it's just interesting. I just find that, like, so upsetting that these poor people. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm just getting kind of emotional about that. Let's talk about Kurt Crawford, this character Kurt Crawford. This is a super interesting character. I the idea is that this is the grown version of the little boy in Heron Vogue that we see, the little clones. And yet Mulder refers to him as a hybrid. So is this part of like the hybridization program? And like, this is when I'm getting into the nerdy and nitty gritty, and I'm sure you're not going to remember what this is. But so what's the difference between like a clone and a hybrid, I suppose?
Well, I think the idea is that these clones are developed using alien and human tissue.
Mm-hmm.
So they are hybrids because there's alien tissue in their makeup, but they are identical. So they're clones as well. So the Samantha clones and the Kurt clones, they're both hybrids and clones.
Right.
Presumably there are other hybrids who aren't necessarily clones. I don't think we ever saw them, but for both of them, they would be clones and hybrids. And I think looking back on that day we spent breaking the story, we thought it would be surprising because I think at that point, when you thought of clones, you thought of the Samanthas from, you know, Colony Endgame.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we thought you won't suspect that this guy is a clone.
Mm.
So we thought, you know, that changing the gender would come about as a...
it would be more of a surprise. Well, because, yeah, you immediately assume when he shows up later and we've already seen him melting into the floor, you immediately assume, oh, well, this is just the alien bounty hunter and he's taken his form. Right. And when that's not the case. So I think it is a really kind of cool way to subvert that. I like that idea. And I mean, we would have wondered what happened to that little boy because we know what happened to Samantha. I mean, I would assume the idea is that these kids are being harvested or farmed or whatever, and they are growing at a normal rate so that like Samantha, when we meet her in Colony Endgame, those initial clones would be that age. But are we to assume that like there are dozens of others, hundreds of others that are like at varying ages, or is this just something that we don't really know?
Yeah, I think that's the kind of thing, honestly, when we were plotting the show, we would have said something like that to ourselves. Like there are many possible answers to that. So that's cool. We'll use that.
Yeah.
And then at some future point in the show, we may or may not be pinned down for an answer.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to that when and if it comes up. But, you know, we can see how that logic holds. And so we're going to go with that for now. And then we'll see later on if we need to refine the logic.
Right. And it's still possible. Like, it's still something that whether you answer it or not, like, there very well may be like an a 12-year-old Samantha out there, a 15-year-old Samantha out there, a 17-year-old just walking around, like, doing their thing. Like, because why wouldn't there be?
That's right.
So it's the logic is sound without having to necessarily answer that question, if that makes sense.
Yes.
But I find that interesting. Jen, did you have anything about the clones? I know we were talking about that.
No, I really like the way that Frank explained it. So now I've got like an equation in my head. All clones are hybrids, but not all hybrids are clones. So that mm-hmm. makes it nice and simple in my mind. So I appreciate that.
A friend of mine actually asked a question that I wanted to put to you. Was the actor who played Kurt Crawford, and his name I don't have in front of me, purposefully cast because he looked a lot like Gillian Anderson? And she said the first time she watched it, when he said there are mothers, that she did a double take because he kind of has very similar features. And I was like, I kind of like that idea. I think that's interesting. Although he is technically supposed to be blonde, right? I was just like, he's that little boy who's blonde. I don't know. I just wanted to know your thoughts on that.
I don't remember the casting process for this episode, but it's entirely possible we would have had that thinking, but I couldn't tell you one way or the other.
Yeah, it's just something. Did you notice that, Jen?
I thought he wasn't as blonde as he was meant to be, which I always found a bit strange because I had always thought of him as a bit of a redhead. So
yeah.
I was surprised when I looked in the script specifically specifying the one thing that was specified about it was that he was meant to be blonde. And I'm like, mm-hmm. not that blonde. So
right.
Like maybe it was just a happy coincidence that he did kind of, to me, look more like a redhead, which did kind of imply maybe there's a Scully connection, but that might just have been one of those happy coincidences that fans just kind of ran with.
Yeah. I mean, just the concept of there being millions of little Uber Scullies running around out there is just mind-blowing to me. But, you know, it is what it is. I am curious about, this is kind of a random question, Frank, and you may not have an answer to this, but there was a huge shift in the episode airing when they decided, when you guys decided to air Leonard Betts on the Super Bowl, and Never Again was supposed to air, but you guys swapped it so that Never Again aired after that. But it was originally supposed to come before. In your mind, do you think that that affects the story? Because I feel like it really sort of does affect the story of Never Again in a huge way that I don't necessarily think was intended by Glenn Morgan. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think it does. But I'll tell you, I mean, my memory is that Glenn and Jim very, very, very much wanted Never Again to be the Super Bowl episode. And my memory is that I very, very, very much wanted it to be Leonard Betts. And my reason for wanting to be Leonard Betts, and obviously I won the argument, was that I thought that Leonard Betts was more emblematic of the show. And like the Super Bowl is going to be the biggest audience X-Files will ever have.
Oh, absolutely.
And
yeah.
You're hoping it'll draw people to the show. And that's Leonard Betts. It's Never Again, which is a great, fascinating episode, is not typical of the show.
You know, right.
It's an outlier. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought it's a mistake if you're trying to draw new fans into the show to have Never Again be that episode. And Leonard Betts has this amazing cliffhanger. It's like, oh my God, well, I'm going to keep watching X-Files then, because, you know, so honestly, that was my only consideration, was what's the best episode to get the biggest audience for the X-Files. And I think actually probably Glenn and Jim were thinking about the creative impact on Never Again as well, which is an argument in their favor. But that was my own consideration.
It's interesting because, I mean, I think Jen and I both absolutely agree with you that Leonard Betts was the correct choice to play at the Super Bowl. But it's interesting because whether that was the case or not, and it's just such an exterior circumstance that ended up affecting the run of the show, it's interesting to me that... especially talking about how maybe Scully subconsciously had been thinking that she might have cancer or that something might be very wrong well before Never Again. When this was sort of brought to my attention, I was like, okay, it doesn't quite bother me as much now that the episode order was changed. But before, that really kind of did, because I liked the idea as Never Again being completely separate from her cancer diagnosis and just being a natural bump in her road in her relationship with Mulder, in her, you know, her stagnation at this job. And I thought that was enough. And so placing it after Leonard Betts now has this added element of, oh, she's just acting this way because she thinks she's dying, which I think takes away so much of Scully's characterization. And not to like blame you guys and be like, you guys messed it up, but it does affect that when I'm watching it in order. It makes, and I think a lot of people might think the same thing who don't really know the backstory about why these episodes are swapped. And Never Again, you have to know, is one of my very favorite episodes. And so it's just an interesting thing that happened. It was just an outside circumstance that ended up actually affecting the way the story plays. And I just find that really interesting. And I'm interested to hear your thoughts on it. So
yeah. Well, but it gets to the point earlier I was saying about how the standalone episodes very rarely had any character development or progression in them. And that's an example of why... You know, they didn't, because we often didn't know what order they actually were going to be broadcast in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember, like in Wet Wired, there is a, you know, it's X shows up at the end, right? Or a cigarette smoking man.
Yeah.
And Chris really didn't like that, because this was a standalone episode and we were blurring the line mm-hmm. between the standalones and the mythology thing. Mm-hmm. So that's an example with Never Again, where it could have an unintended consequence because of the broadcast order.
Yeah, I always think that too about Wet Wired. I actually really like that as a fan. I think, Jen, you do too, that when the episodes are sort of blurred and you can pull in a teeny tiny bit of mythology into a Monster of the Week. I always find that really fascinating.
I thought it was super cool. I'm so excited to do it.
But. Yeah. Well, I mean, and like you said about Leonard Betts, like that's a perfectly standalone episode on its own, but then I'm assuming later when you guys decided last minute to do the cancer art, that was that scene with Scully at the end, then was it a pickup or was it added in time during the filming or
added in time during the filming? Yeah, okay. We were able to do it.
It was just a really cool way to very like bring in the mythology, but like right at the end, like you said, it was perfect. It was a perfect episode that people might watch their first X-Files episode. Perfect and great. Well done.
Yeah. And I think that when we're looking at the series now, folks that didn't necessarily watch it when it was airing, it's easy to forget all of the other extraneous factors that came into the airing of the episodes. This was a network show, and it wasn't necessarily about what is the absolute perfect arc. It was about what are we going to air for the Super Bowl? And that was the reality of it. And that's the way it turned out. And that was the way network television always has been. But I think that we're so used to sort of streaming television now, and things can be in whatever order they want to be. So we have to kind of remember that. I'm sure you guys would have, you know, not necessarily done things the way you did them, but you had to do them the way that the business required.
Yeah.
Well, and I have to say, like, thinking back to doing 24 episodes of television a year, you know, now, you know, if you do 12, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And 24 episodes a year, all that time, it's incredible, actually.
Yeah. It really is.
I don't know
it
how you guys incredible. Did it.
It's amazing to me.
Let's talk about the Lone Gunman for a little bit. Whose idea was it to bring the Lone Gunman into this episode? Because I think it was such a great place for them. And in a way, like Jen was saying earlier, it sort of involves them in the story, in their personal lives, because they already know about this. I mean, it's a great parallel because they were the ones that helped Mulder figure it out in one breath. And now they're back sort of helping continue this story. So what was the idea behind bringing them into the episode?
I don't know if I can take credit, but I would like to take credit for it. I was always trying to bring the Lone Gunman and Skinner into everything as often as I could.
Nice.
I just felt like this is the family of the show. And I know as a fan, like I like seeing the family of the show in the show. And so like, you know, having them ice skating, you know, or I was always things to, you know, like I just wanted them to be in stuff. And I thought this is a good role for them to play, you know, supporting Mulder in this sort of Mission Impossible, you know, assignment. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was me, but I can't say for certain whether it was me or Vince or John.
I'm just going to say thank you so much for any time you managed to fit the Lone Gunman into an episode, because it always delights me and Skinner too. So I'm really happy to hear that.
Well, we're the same kind of fan then, because I love that. Yeah, and I felt the same way about Krychek and about, you know, whether it was X or Marita Covarrubias. I felt like these, you know, it just gives the show a context, a character context that I really liked, and I was always eager to use them as much as we could.
Yeah, I mean, even the characters like Krychek or Smoking Man, whoever, like, it's kind of like, oh, our old friends are back, like the gang is back together. Like, I remember there's that scene in Requiem where they're literally all standing around the table like a Last Supper type shot, eating takeout. And I every time I watch that, I'm like, how did we end up here? Like, how is this a thing that's happening? But it's so great because it's like the gang's all here. So I get that feeling that every time they're back, everything feels slightly more weighty and important. And that's, it's great. Yes.
And it felt that way to us too. It felt like, oh, they're back. Oh, this is so great to have them back. Or when you brought back somebody who had been killed in the show, it was always great to have them back. And you know, literally, like if you were in Vancouver on a Friday night, if you went into the Girard Lounge at the Sutton Place Hotel, there they all were, you know, there was Ken. Was Mitch Pileggi, and there was Nick Lee, and it was amazing.
What a time, man. What a time to be alive.
Yeah.
Love it. This season, season four is one of my favorite seasons, and so especially when you bring up Krychek. I mean, we were just recently talking about the Tunguska Terma two-parter, which I also really love. I just love anytime Krychek's in the episodes. They always have this feeling of like you said, they're plot driven, but they're also able to push these characters along, and everything slightly feels more important when you're watching a mythology episode. Like the stakes are so much higher, and I think that's part of what makes the mythology of the show so great. So
Yeah, and like you say, Frank, that's where a lot of the character stuff happens too, is in those mythology episodes, which makes them, you know, doubly weighty.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And I feel like you're deepening the audience's relationship to the characters in those episodes. And yeah, and Tunguska Terma, I remember when Nick, oh great, I'm going to be back, and then when he read the scene where his arm got sawed off, he was so excited.
Yeah.
Wow, this is fantastic.
That is just brutal. I enjoy that because God, anytime anything kind of happens to Krychek where he gets a little bit of comeuppance, I enjoy that.
There's lots of that.
Oh my God. Awesome, awesome. Well, let's talk about this last scene in Memento Mori, which I think is kind of what comes to a lot of fans' minds when we are talking about this episode, where Scully sort of, you know, reveals that she had been prepared to give up, but is changing her mind and has decided to, you know, persist and keep working. There is a, I'm sure you're aware of this, Frank, because people on Twitter all the time bug you about deleted kisses between Mulder and Scully. There was a kiss in this scene where Mulder kisses her on the lips, which would have been the first kiss. But I personally, as much of a huge shipper as I am, I think it was wisely removed. But can you tell us about that? Like, where did that come from? Was that on the day? And then you guys just were like, this isn't the right time? Or like, how did that all come about? And how did that get deleted?
Yeah, that was on the day. And that was David and Jillian decided to do it. And I think Rob knew that we weren't going to go for it. But he let them do it. I don't know whether it was one or two takes as an option. And that knowing could decide in the editing room whether it was the right thing to do. But I felt like, yeah, you, to some degree, it was very clear to us that this was a love story between Mulder and Scully. You know, certainly by season four was absolutely clear. And I just felt like, is this really the moment for this to happen?
And
I felt strongly then, and I still feel strongly, no, it was not, because it's confusing things. It's like, this is said about her mortality, and does she, you know, keep working, and we know they love each other. That's already clear, you know, but the romantic fulfillment of that, having the kiss happen at that moment, I just thought, no, that's not the right time. It's too much. And it would kind of, especially at that point, like in real time in television history in season four, that would have been all people talked about that episode was, oh,
right.
they finally kissed.
Yep.
Right. That's would have been a distraction. So I still think it was the right thing to do to not have them kiss there. And then of course in the movie, and again, let's remember, like, these things are being plotted close in time to each other. Just the same issue, you know, is that the right moment for them to actually kiss? And you know the answer. You know what our answer was.
Yeah, I agree with Annie that it was the right choice. And I just remember at the time, you know, we've got like, it's this really beautiful forehead kiss, which is much more appropriate, I think, for the tone. And I just remember at the time, my shippers were like, forehead kiss. We were just so excited about that. That was plenty for us.
That
so
was enough, right? That was enough. That might be the first one, was it?
I think it is.
Might be the first time he kissed her on the forehead, which would have been a big deal in and of itself. But
it
like
was
you
a
said,
big deal.
Yeah, like you said, though, Frank, I mean, it would have, I feel like all those weird mixed signals would have just made it wrong. Like, I love seeing the deleted scene. Don't get me wrong. It's lovely, but it doesn't belong there. So I completely agree with you. And I mean, knowing that you're writing Fight the Future at the same time and the impact that hallway scene is going to have, and then obviously the choice that you guys made to not have them kiss, which I also agree was the correct choice, that imagine the impact that would have taken away from that. It wouldn't have existed. That scene wouldn't have existed. And so good call. Props to David and Jillian for wanting to kiss for no reason, but we'll take it. We'll take the deleted scene. And you know what? Since we have you and we're talking about deleted kisses, because I know we've nailed you down on Twitter in the past about that they kissed in Postmodern Prometheus as well. You're nodding very, very enthusiastically. They did. You say they did.
They did.
Okay.
And again, it was their idea again. And again, it was like, okay, we'll do it. I mean, I remember Chris calling me and saying, you know, look, they've kissed, but don't worry. I have it without them kissing too.
don't worry.
But, you know, I think David and Jillian more than anybody, were aware of this incredible chemistry they had on mm-hmm. camera. And they were, you know, looking for the right moment to kind of exploit that, you know. And I guess, you know, I was firmly in the camp of less is more and don't go too fast. And actually, and this is, you know, heresy to people that, you know, love this relationship. To me, it's more romantic when it's not sexual. It's the yearning that makes it so powerful.
Yes.
Not the fulfillment.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with that, too. I mean, that's what made this these characters so quote unquote shippable, so fascinating, is that it never quite went there. Like, it was always the sort of underlying tension, and you don't want to get rid of that too soon. So, like,
valuable. I think maybe even the X-Files fandom may have created the whole UST unresolved sexual tension thing, because we were talking about it before anyone else was, and no one did it better than the X-Files.
Yeah. And it's funny because we talked about this last time, Frank, but even when it was resolved, it was not resolved on screen. And so there was always this mystery still as to what was going on. Like, and the way you guys were able to sort of kind of give the shippers what they wanted and yet still maintain plausible deniability. I don't want to say plausible deniability. There's a baby. But maintain this sort of mystery and still doling it out piecemeal. It was just really a brilliant move. And I think that is what makes their relationship so unique and so special. So bravo.
And honestly, we only did the baby when we knew we were losing David.
Yeah.
I was like, we were very strategic about it the whole time.
Right. That's amazing. Well, I mean, Frank, this was amazing. Jen, do you have any more questions that that I failed to remember here?
I don't think so. I guess the only other one that I maybe would spring to mind is, you know, given how sort of, I mean, it's an amazing episode. It's one of my favorite episodes. It's one of those ones that kind of flips in and out of my number one spot, and it probably has my heart forever more than any other episode. So obviously it turned out brilliantly, but I wonder if, looking back on how quickly you had to bring it together, is there, I mean, it seems kind of a crazy question because of how well it turned out, but is there anything you feel like, if you'd had more time to write it, would you have written it any differently?
Yes, I'm sure. And to be honest, I can't look at any of the episodes and not think there are things I would do differently. But that probably says more about me than about the episodes. But I'm sure there's things we would have done differently. The reason I have so much affection for the show is because, for all the reasons we've discussed, and that it was so close to never happening, and then it did happen, then it turned out so well, and it's the only one we got nominated for an Emmy for writing as well, which is so funny. Yeah.
Out of the entire series?
Out of the entire series, it's the only.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, Darren was nominated and won for Clyde Bruckman, but the rest of us, that's the only one we got a nomination. Yeah.
It's amazing. I think the X-Files exemplifies so well how well you guys dealt with curveballs, because I love, you know, the Scully abduction arc, which obviously was a result of Jillian's pregnancy, and Memento Mori, obviously one of my favorites again because of another curveball. And I think it's just amazing how these little miracles came from extenuating circumstances.
Yeah.
Yeah, we tried to make lemonade for sure.
Yeah, it was the most delicious lemonade as well.
Thank you.
Well, Frank, this was fantastic. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Thank you.
Well, thanks everybody for listening. We will be back with you in a couple weeks. In the meantime, please do tweet at us at XFDpodcast on Twitter. We want to hear anything that you have to say about today's episode or anything X-Files related, really. And we will catch up with you on the next episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye.